From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump attended the swearing-in of his CIA pick, Gina Haspel, saying there's no one in the country better qualified to run the CIA. Also today, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo laid out the new U.S. policy on Iran after President Trump pulled out of the multinational Iran nuclear deal. Pompeo threatened the strongest sanctions in history if Iran doesn't comply. But this morning's headlines were about the president's demand yesterday that the Justice Department investigate whether the FBI infiltrated or surveilled his campaign for political purposes. Right after the president's tweet, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein asked the department's Office of the Inspector General to expand an existing investigation into techniques used to get a FISA warrant to surveil campaign aide Carter Page to now include the president's claims of an embedded FBI spy. Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department for NPR. He joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
And this all exploded after the New York Times reported that there was a government informant in the Russia investigation who talked to three Trump aides. What claims is the president making? Is there evidence that this was a spy?
Well, first off, there's no evidence that the investigation generally was politically motivated for political purposes. And this, of course, is something that the president has alleged for, well, months now. What we do know is that the investigation began with a tip related to then foreign policy aide George Papadopoulos talking about the Russians having dirt on Hillary Clinton. That's when the FBI began its counterintelligence investigation. That would have been towards the end of July in 2016. We know that other individuals within the Trump campaign had ties with Russians that were a source of concern for folks in the U.S. national security establishment. And so it appears as though there was outreach by the part of the FBI to try to determine the extent of these contacts and whether this, you know, merited further investigation.
And just to jog people's memory, because this gets confusing, if I got this right, the George Papadopoulos investigation was because he was bragging in a bar room to an Australian diplomat that Moscow had these had dirt on Hillary Clinton, had emails, and then a little bit later those emails came out. And so that's when the Australian officials contacted U.S. officials and the investigation of Papadopoulos began.
That's right.
Okay. Yes. Well, at the heart of this also seems to be a tussle over documents. House Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes subpoenaed the Justice Department a month ago for documents related to the professor who reportedly was this informant, this source for the FBI and undercover. We're not naming him. The department said exposing him would put him and his contacts in danger. But now the New York Post, the Daily Caller, several outlets have exposed him, named him. And we're reading that there's fear that on the part of the Department of Justice officials that President Trump might be pushing for those documents as well. I mean, what are the concerns there?
Well, the FBI Director Christopher Wray was asked kind of in an oblique manner about this at a hearing last week. And what he said is, look, if we can't protect confidential sources at the FBI, then that is going to endanger national security because we need those people to take risks. We need those people to be able to gather information that we can then use to protect the country. And if we aren't able to protect those people, people aren't going to want to take risks for us.
Okay. Well, meanwhile, this is all about the Russia investigation. The president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, says that Mueller told him that the investigation into President Trump's role in any obstruction of justice would be wrapped by September 1st. Where are we on whether or not the president will be speaking with Mueller?
Well, I spoke with Giuliani yesterday about this, and he did say that September 1st, that's when they're aiming for. But it was contingent upon a couple of things. One, he said that the interview would have to take place by mid-July, early to mid-July. Now, at the same point in time, Giuliani has also frequently referred to the amount of work that the president needs to do now. He has the meeting with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, about denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. He has the Iran deal that he's still that he's scrapped and is now trying to work out a new agreement on. And so Giuliani has kind of been positioning this as it's going to be very difficult to find the time for the president to sit down with Mueller's team. Plus, Giuliani came out with new conditions that he wanted, wants it to be a short interview, wants to know the questions ahead of time. So kind of putting all the pressure publicly on Mueller to get this done. Mm. And Mueller, of course, does not speak publicly. His special counsel's office doesn't discuss this. So this may be in large part a campaign by Giuliani to kind of ramp up the pressure on Mueller as this goes on.
Ryan Lucas covers the Justice Department for NPR. Ryan, thank you.
My pleasure.
And we're keeping an eye on the investigation in Santa Fe, Texas, after last week's deadly school shooting. But today also marks 20 years since another school tragedy, well before names like Columbine, Sandy Hook, Parkland, and now Santa Fe. There was Thurston High School in Springfield, Oregon, where then 15-year-old Kip Kinkle shot and killed two classmates and injured two dozen more. Kinkle also killed his parents in their home the night before. Brian Bull from member station KLCC revisits this story, an early example of a modern-day epidemic.
Outside of the main campus of Thurston High School stands a brick and tile wall, along with benches, plaque, and trees. The Thurston Memorial features 25 white tiles symbolizing students wounded on May 21, 1998. Two black ones represent students Mikhail Nicolason and Ben Walker, who died that day. 35-year-old Tony McCown watches the students mill on and off the campus, much like he did when he went here.
I've probably been out here a half dozen times or so for different events, and there may be a half dozen other times for just my own thoughts and memories.
McCown was gunman Kip Kinkle's best friend. He wrestles with not being able to foresee the violence that came to his school. He recalls the day before when Kip was escorted off campus by Springfield police for having a .32-caliber gun in his locker. He'd bought the weapon from another classmate. Kip was released to his father that same afternoon.
Maybe there would have been another trigger, but I honestly believe if he had not been caught with that gun on that day, that we would not have had May 21st. Was he a ticking time bomb? Possibly. It's just so hard to say.
The night before the shooting, McCown talked over the phone to Kip about his pending expulsion. What McCown didn't know is that Kip had already murdered his father, Bill Kinkle, with a shot to the head with a .22-caliber rifle. Kip's mother, Faith, would be shot to death a few hours later and left in the garage. In a recorded confession with a Springfield police detective, Kinkle described hearing voices and his head not being right.
You told me that your mom gets out of the Explorer and starts up the stairs from the garage or basement, is that right?
Yes.
Do you say anything to her?
Yes. I told her I loved her.
And then you
God damn it, these voices are fun in my head!
All right, thank you. Settle down.
Kip Kinkle drove himself the next day to Thurston High. Clad in a trench coat and a 9-inch nails cap, he brought a .22-caliber rifle, two pistols, a knife, and more than 1,000 rounds of ammo. Outside the cafeteria, he shot two students, Ben Walker and Ryan Atterbury. He then entered the cafeteria and opened fire. Bettina Lynn recalls hearing popping sounds and thought some classmates had set off fireworks.
And I felt something impact me from behind in my back. At this point, I was very, very angry. Like, who's pulling a stupid prank that's putting us all in danger? I turned around, and the moment the second bullet hit my foot, I noticed the gun.
Before being tackled by a group of students, Kinkle managed to shoot one classmate, 17-year-old Mikhail Nicolason, in the head at point-blank range. The boy died on the scene. Ben Walker, the 16-year-old shot in the breezeway, would die within the day. Days later, President Clinton spoke of the tragedy in a Memorial Day address.
And my thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families. Like all Americans, I am struggling to make sense of the senseless.
A year later, Kinkle, despite previous references to voices in his head, dropped his insanity plea and pleaded guilty to 4 counts of murder and 26 counts of attempted murder. He's serving 112 years at the Oregon State Correctional Institution. Back at Thurston High, junior Rio Samaniego says the school and community have largely forgotten about the tragedy. But he says the event spurred him to join the March for Our Lives movement.
It definitely is a driving force behind my activism. Just the fact that it happened in this community, that I know people whose lives changed that day, it scares me personally, because my life could be in danger.
And another survivor, who was almost written off as dead, managed to come off the operating table, rise to his feet, and literally reach for the stars.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0. And liftoff.
I'm currently working at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
We build scientific instruments for spacecraft.
Shooting survivor Tony Case lives in Massachusetts now. He's seen many of his projects launch from Cape Canaveral. Case says he doesn't dwell much on the Thurston shooting, but he does mark the occasion with those who helped him survive.
I've actually become really good friends with the surgeon and anesthesiologist that worked on me. And every May 21st, we at least send around an email between my parents, me, my doctors, all of us just sort of saying thank you to the doctors mostly for giving me a second chance at life.
As for Kip Kinkle, his defense has tried several times to get his time reduced. Earlier this month, the Oregon Supreme Court upheld his 112-year sentence, rejecting arguments that a life sentence for a juvenile violated his constitutional rights against cruel and unusual punishment. Meanwhile, Thurston High student Rio Samaniego says there will be a ceremony tonight at the memorial in Springfield, followed by a candlelight vigil at a local park. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Bull.
It started with a song.
Angels smoking cigarettes on rooftops in fishnets in the morning with the moon still glowing. And here comes Jesus in an Astro van rolling down the strip again. He's stoned while Jerry plays.
That's Astro Van by the band Mount Joy, racked up about 6 million streams since it was first released on Spotify in September 2016. This March, the band released its self-titled debut album. They've toured with big names like Nico Case, Head in the Heart, and The Shins. And NPR Music has called Mount Joy one of the best emerging bands of 2018. And as we're about to hear, their success epitomizes the way the music industry is changing in the age of streaming. Matt Quinn co-founded Mount Joy. He's lead singer and he plays the guitar. Matt, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And congratulations. It sounds like it's been quite a whirlwind for the last year or so for you.
Yeah, it's been a crazy year. Wouldn't have expected that I would maybe even be touring musician right now, so a year ago.
Well, let's talk about that because you, from what I'm hearing, you have this modern story. You and your bandmates were discovered on Spotify in part because of that song Astrovan. How did it happen?
Yeah, you know, Sam Cooper and I, who I went to high school with outside of Philadelphia, both sort of ended up in Los Angeles and were kind of after work writing songs, and we'd always played music our whole lives, but, you know, just sort of had fallen into day jobs, and, you know, we decided we had a few songs, one of them being Astrovan, that we wanted to record, and it found its way to Spotify, and the success there was pretty immediate. I think we did like a million streams in the first month, and it was kind of like, okay, let's do this.
And did you expect that to happen when you put the songs out? Because there were four of them, right?
Yeah. So we started out just putting Astrovan out, and there was no expectation that that would happen. I was doing law school night classes. Sam was an attorney, I think, but yeah, it just took off on us.
So it used to be you get discovered, you get signed to a label, you make a record, you start touring, but you kind of did the whole thing backwards. I just wonder if you think that this is sort of the new normal in music, if we're going to start to see a lot more of this.
Yeah, I think, you know, it requires a little bit of luck in terms of the song being discovered on that level. But I do think it's certainly now a viable way to start a music career. I think it's way more efficient than getting out there and because I did that too. I went to school in Boston, played around town, and, you know, I had some fun, but certainly no success or anything that would have led to a career. So I think that's a really, really hard way to cut your teeth, and it's possible. But I think having these platforms is a much more efficient way to get heard.
Yeah. And what do you think it is about Astrovan, the song? I mean, I listen to it. I have some serious nostalgia. I grew up in an era when the Astrovan played quite a role in a lot of people's lives.
It was a song sort of about a person. You know, I was just someone who was, you know, had always dreamed of being a musician, and I think it's sort of about following your dreams, and then, of course, the The goofy line about Jesus driving an Astrovan, I think, catches people's attention. Is it life ain't ever what it seems? These dreams are more than paper things. It's all right, mama, you're afraid I'll be poor along the way. But I don't want to see those tears again. You know Jesus drives an Astrovan. When we first started touring, we did a festival in Canada, and they said that we were going to play Astrovan and maybe one other song, and that we would be sharing the stage with a bunch of other musicians, which sounded really cool. And we got up there and realized that we were playing to a like gospel worship session in front of like 1,000 people. And none of us are, well, for the most part, we're not a particularly religious band, but we sort of realized halfway through that the songs that the other artists were playing were sort of faith-based songs, and that we had been kind of thrust up there because of Astrovan. It was hilarious to us, the whole thing.
Plus, when you're just starting out, like, that was 1,000 people who never probably had heard your name before.
Yeah, and, you know, they were very receptive, and it was great, but you're singing about Jesus smoking weed at a worship thing, and you're like, this, how did I get here? When I see those angels on the roof, I know I've made it. When my doobie smoking Jesus puts my name upon his guest list.
Well, let's talk about another song that you released on Spotify. This is Sheep. Blood owes me, I can't fall asleep, cause it's rootless, and don't tell me you're rootless too. When there's blood on the streets of Baltimore, kids are getting ready for a long war. Maybe I was born in the wrong skin, but those sheep are rolling in the mud again. Like, whoa. Matt, you're right. There's blood on the streets of Baltimore. Of course, sounds like a reference to Freddie Gray, the black man who died in police custody in 2015. Is that right? What are you trying to say with this song?
Yeah, so I started writing that song, again, not being a touring musician or anything, just writing as sort of a release to a frustration from, you know, when that happened. And as it started to become an epidemic sort of all over our country, Mountjoy was sort of starting to write these other four songs, and so sort of kept adding to it, and it became this song that I think for us just encapsulates the frustration of whether it was the election or just in general the way our country and I think maybe even globally the treatment of minorities is just, I think it was just an extremely frustrating time. Specifically, that was right around the election. I think, you know, the sheep idea was just these people seem to be following this ideology of hate pretty blindly, and it was frustrating. So I think that's where that song came from.
I'm just wondering if, you know, as you wade into politics in your music, if you're worried at all that that could become alienating, or is that how you want people to see your music, that you're a band that is going to make it a point to weigh in on the politics of the moment?
Yeah, I think totally. I think, you know, I don't want someone necessarily to connect with our art that is like, you know, someone who is hateful or, you know, not even necessarily politically. I think what we're searching for is pretty simple stuff. Like, you know, we're trying to eradicate people who, for reasons of color of skin or something like that, would possibly hate someone. I think we just, if you're not a good person, I don't really want you to like my music. So.
Well, look, you're doing something similar with your song Silver Lining. It's all over the radio. It's been in the top 10 recently on the AAA charts. It's a song about drug overdoses.
Yeah.
Did the issue touch your life personally, or was it just something that you noticed happening around you?
Yeah, it touched my life personally. I had some friends that I went to high school with that passed away, but also just when that was happening, I had, you know, people around me, whether it was in school or friends who were going through similar things, and it just seemed it fully has become just an epidemic. But if it's the drugs, the women, the white, the weak, the love,
well, we mentioned there were four original songs that you initially put out to the world on Spotify, and that eventually led to the album. But I want you to tell me about another song on the album that you sort of created after you made it and were recognized by people that epitomizes who you are and what it is that you're trying to do.
I think the song for me would probably be Bigfoot. It's just a song, you know, that we kind of in the beginning, it was just me and Sam. And then, you know, all this stuff happened and we were tasked with, you know, putting together a band. And it was unclear, like, how exactly that would work. But we got really lucky right away and got, you know, an amazing group of musicians that have become, you know, really close. And I think that song sort of epitomizes the way we'll make music going forward. It was pretty democratic. And it really, I think, speaks to where we want to go as sort of being a band that can really put together a wide variety of different types of music.
What strikes me about your success is that it came so rapidly. You go from this Spotify uploader to performing at Bonnaroo to the Newport Folk Festival. You played on Conan earlier this year. Do you sometimes think that your fame came so fast that it could vanish just as easily?
Yeah, I think, you know, one, I certainly don't feel like we've, like, acquired fame. But I do think that everything we've accomplished could easily go away. And I think that that's kind of the challenge that we've always had from the beginning, where it was like, you know, you put up a song and it does really well. It's like, well, what will the next one do? You've got to bat 1,000 to be successful in the beginning. So I think every band sort of feels, or at least I would imagine, feels that pressure in the beginning to make sure everything you're putting out when people are paying attention is worthwhile. And in some ways, I think it's fair that if you're not, you'll kind of fall off.
Yeah. Matt Quinn is co-founder, vocalist, and guitarist of the band Mount Joy, which is making a name for itself. Matt, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you guys so much. Stay forever, old benches together, the mountains fall into the sea. If I built the frame that gave you my name, would you wander forever with me and drive way up over mountains? Where everyone's free
to move how they feel. The Supreme Court handed a big victory to employers today. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled that companies can force workers to settle disagreements individually instead of banding together in class action lawsuits. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School, is here. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
And we know this concerns agreements that go to arbitration. This covers an estimated 25 million workers in the U.S., and sometimes there's hundreds, thousands in these agreements. So explain more about what this ruling means.
So the employees who were trying to sue in these cases were complaining about wage theft, and they had cases that were small individually but added up to a lot together. And so what they tried to do was go to federal court and sue together in what's called a class action, because it's the kind of case that if you go on your own, it's hard to get a lawyer interested because there's not enough money at stake. Mm-hmm. And they were arguing that because the wage theft was a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is like our big national labor law, that they should be allowed into court rather than being bound by private arbitration, which is a way that employers try to bar employees from getting to regular court. Arbitration is private and you have to do it one by one according to the contracts that these employees had signed.
So is the ruling that you have to do this one by one?
Yes, that's the ruling. It's a ruling that gives a lot of power to employers. Once employees sign these kind of take it or leave it contracts and arbitration is in place, it's binding and it covers all kinds of things that are also covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. So if you think you have a wage theft claim, you now have to go by yourself to private arbitration. You can't band together and go to court, even though you still have your collective bargaining rights under the Fair Labor Standards
Act. So Judge Neil Gorsuch wrote the decision today. What was his reasoning?
His reasoning is that the Federal Arbitration Act, which was passed in 1925, is enforceable. And he said that nothing in the national labor laws changes that, that essentially, whether it was a good idea or not, as a policy matter, these employees sign these contracts and the contracts are binding and employers can enforce them.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the dissent, actually summarized her reasoning from the bench today, which you tell us is rare. What did she say?
Yeah, she did that. It's usually a sign that a justice feels really strongly. And what she said was that this was decision is a terrible mistake because it will lead to under enforcement of laws that are designed to protect workers and especially vulnerable workers. One study estimates that in just three cities, Chicago, L.A. and New York City, low wage workers lose nearly $3 billion a year in wages that they are owed. And so this decision is going to make it much harder for them to recover the money that their employers are essentially pilfering from them.
Because it would seem an insurmountable task to go by yourself to court for some people. But are we going to see fewer class action lawsuits because of this, do you think?
Yes, we will. And this is part of a kind of march the Supreme Court has been on now for several years to really minimize and limit class action lawsuits. And, you know, it can sound kind of technical and wonky, but whether you can band together and go to court as a group or have to go by one often determines whether the case can be brought at all. Because as we all know, you know, lawyers are expensive. This is a way of spreading the costs out, whether it's employees or consumers.
Hmm. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, fellow at the Yale Law School on today's Supreme Court decision that companies can force workers to settle disagreements individually instead of in class action lawsuits. Emily, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Health workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo began vaccinating people today against an outbreak of Ebola that's killed at least 27 people. This is the first time a vaccine will be used to control an Ebola outbreak. Dr. Seth Berkley joins us now. He's an infectious disease epidemiologist and CEO of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, a group that's providing money and logistical support to get that vaccine distributed. Dr. Berkley, welcome. And vaccinations are starting today in Bandoka, a city of more than a million people. First, your thoughts on the severity of this outbreak now that it's spread to this very urban area.
Well, first of all, you know, the good news is that DRC is a country that has experience with Ebola. It is the country where Ebola was first seen. And so over this last 40 years, they've had 9 outbreaks. Obviously, they've been of varying intensity, but they've been able to control them using public health measures. Now, the last outbreak was a smaller outbreak. It was able to be controlled completely using public health means and didn't require a use of a vaccine. We now have a vaccine, and that is what is exciting and additional that can be done here. But of course, the fact that this is now moved into the provincial capital, where there's a large number of people, does raise a significant level of concern.
And it will be tough work getting people vaccinated. A top official from the World Health Organization, Peter Salama, said recently that the vaccination effort would be very complex, in part because the drug is still in those early stages. Here he is.
And there are a lot of complications with using an experimental vaccine, which requires to be kept in the long term at between negative 60 and negative 80 degrees Celsius. So this is not a simple logistical effort. This is a highly complex, sophisticated operation in one of the most difficult terrains on Earth.
Doctor, what's your take on the logistical challenges of this operation?
Well, first of all, this is one of the most difficult places on Earth. This is in a, you know, a heavy tropical rainforest without good infrastructure. Now, the specific difficult challenge that Peter talked about, the temperature stability issue, is a challenge. I mean, the good news on that is that there are special carriers that can be used to transport the vaccine out to the emergency site and keep it at that temperature. And then you can take it out of that temperature and keep it in a fridge, a normal fridge from 2 to 8 degrees for a period of time as you are going ahead to use the vaccine. Now, once you take it out of that condition, once you've had it in the fridge, then if you don't use it in a period of time, you have to dispose of it. So we have to be very careful to try to keep it in that cold chain, but there is some flexibility in doing that. But it is going to be a very different task indeed.
And what's the strategy to get the vaccine to the people? I've been reading about something called a ring fencing technique. What is that? How does it work?
So the ring vaccination idea really came from work by Dr. William Fagy, former head of CDC, when he worked around smallpox. The original way people worked to try to get rid of smallpox was you'd have an outbreak and they would try to cover the entire, you know, district, community, country. And what he came up with the idea was if you didn't have enough vaccine, you could go to the case that had it, and then you could say who did the case have contact with, and even extending it out further to people that, you know, the contacts had contacts with.
So family members, that sort of thing.
Family members, friends, you know, if you've traveled outside, you've taken a taxi, if you've, you know, been to a funeral, and all the people you've met. So the idea is to create a ring of protection around the cases to slow down transmission. That was what was done in Guinea. It was somewhere between 100 and 150 contacts per case, and that is the strategy that's going to be used here. Of course, on top of that, we will want to vaccinate the healthcare workers and, you know, burial workers or others that are directly involved with the cases.
But if this virus continues to spread in urban areas, are there enough vaccines to go around? I mean, there's only a limited stockpile as far as I can understand.
Well, when Gavi originally made the commitment to work with the Merck Corporation, one of the agreements was that they would put aside 300,000 doses of vaccine, which is a substantial number. Now, the idea behind that is, you know, some of those doses are available immediately, but also in that process, if it looks like we need more doses, they can go ahead and turn on their manufacturing and produce more doses. So I would say at the moment, I'm not worried about those number of doses. The more important issue is moving as quickly as possible to get this vaccination started and to make sure that we are reaching the contacts and then doing this ring vaccination around them.
How confident are you that this vaccine is going to do the job and contain the outbreak?
Well, I'm confident that the vaccine itself is effective. We've seen that in clinical trials and in animal studies, and will do what it needs to do. Of course, it only can work if you can track the cases and then the contacts with them. So that is always the complicated picture. But this is the first time that we're systematically going to be doing vaccination for an outbreak other than the clinical trial in Guinea. So it is a new experience.
Dr. Seth Berkley, CEO of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you so much.
And now to Thailand, where there's an ambitious plan for a new canal that could have a big impact on shipping in the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Michael Sullivan reports.
I'm in a small fishing boat on the Andaman Sea with Sitichai Bormuang, a local fisherman who knows both the area and the plan for the canal well. If you look at where I'm pointing, on the shore, you can see the mouth of the Galisay River, he says. That's where the canal will start. He's a fan. Says it's high time the underdeveloped South gets the economic benefits other parts of the country now enjoy. And he's not alone. Just a few hundred yards inland, along the Galisay, Jarit Tayuang has a shrimp farm patrolled by a few mangy-looking dogs. The farm would disappear if the canal is approved, but he says the short-term pain is worth the long-term gain. I know I'll lose my land here, he says, but the canal will create jobs and improve the economy for our children, for their future. It's an idea first considered in the late 1600s by Thailand's King Narai, who commissioned a French engineer to see if it would work, but then lost interest. Now, an influential group of retired generals and businessmen say the time is right.
We wait for a long time. 340 years, I think, is long enough.
That's retired general and former Army Chief of Staff Prongtep Tespratip.
I think it's obvious that Thai Canal project has many benefits, not only for Thai people, but also the people around the world.
An energy-hungry world, especially China, Japan, and South Korea, who'd love the idea of an 80-mile-long, $30 billion canal that would connect the Indian and Pacific Oceans, an alternative to the busy and congested Malacca Strait near Singapore.
I think it has game-changing potential that would have a tangible impact on shipping lanes.
John Hillman directs the Reconnecting Asia project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
One of the main selling points is that it would cut about 1,200 kilometers off of a shipping route from the Persian Gulf to Asian ports. And that translates into about 72 hours of shipping time. That's enough to change the way that you ship.
It would also help guarantee China's energy security, since a large quantity of its oil flows through the Malacca Strait, a potential choke point in any future conflict. One reason China appears happy to finance the project, according to Bangkok businessman Pakdi Tanapura. The walls of his office are covered in pictures that show the canal and vast new developments, cities even, that would spring up on either side. Illustrations provided by a Chinese developer, and not just any developer.
Longhao is a very important company in China because Longhao is the company that built islands in the South China Sea. They are very proud about it because they can build islands within 2 years. That's why they said that, oh, Grand Canal is no problem at all.
And it's not just China that's eager to see the canal become a reality.
We hope that they do it because we believe there's a good opportunity just from the business point of view.
Rolf Dieter Daniel is a past president and current board member of the European Association for Business and Commerce in Thailand.
Don't forget that the Malacca Strait is very, very much congested. And it will become even more congested in the future because the traffic is increasing all the time. And that means we need another route.
Thailand's military-led government isn't opposed to the idea, but says any feasibility study will have to wait until a new government is formed after general elections scheduled for next year. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Bangkok.
Seattle's mountain biking community is rattled after this weekend's cougar attack that left one man dead, another injured, in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains outside the city. Police say the men first noticed the cougar chasing them. They got off their bikes, tried to scare it off. One man was mauled but managed to bike 2 miles to get cell phone reception and call 911. Police found the cougar standing over the second man's body. The cougar ran, police tracked and killed it, and autopsy is being performed. Because this is rare, this is only the second death from a cougar attack in Washington state in the last 100 years. Richard Beausoleil is the bear and cougar specialist with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Richard, you say your phone is ringing off the hook with people calling. What did you think when you heard about the attack?
You know, I guess when I first learned about it, my thoughts were with the individuals and the families.
Yeah.
I mean, we know how rare this situation is, but it didn't make it any better for me. And both victims were from Seattle.
Well, we'll talk about what we have heard, that this animal, a young cougar, maybe 3 to 4 years old, and maybe underweight. Does that tell you anything?
We do know that the cougar was at least 30 pounds underweight, should have been about 100 and, you know, 30, maybe 140 pounds, and it was 101 pounds.
Well, it's funny. Just this morning, we opened in the mail a brand new book, Path of the Puma, The Remarkable Resilience of the Mountain Lion by Jim Williams. And by the way, mountain lion, puma, cougar, are they all the same?
They're all the same.
And in this beautiful book, he talks again about how rare these attacks are. 117 attacks in the U.S. and Canada between 1890 and 2005 resulted in just 19 human fatalities. But of course, when there is a fatality, everybody perks up. Is it true that the mountain lion, the cougar, does not like to attack humans?
We've had 20 instances, including these two, over the last 100 years of some kind of incident that we would clump into, you know, what we would call generally an attack. Overwhelmingly, these are from hikers, bikers, joggers that tend to come around a corner in the woods fairly quickly, and animals use those roads as well. And so the majority of these are surprise encounters, defensive type situations. Most all of them come away with very minor injuries, more of just falling off their bikes or trying to pick up some sticks and defend themselves and that kind of thing. And almost always the cougar runs away. But of those 20, we've had 8 instances where there's been serious injuries, and that is including now this second death.
Yeah. Well, what are you supposed to do if you encounter a cougar or a mountain lion?
You definitely want to show the animal that you are not prey. They are used to their prey running away. And so the very first thing is to stop, stand tall, make some noise, throw something at the animal if you can, but do not run. Mm. Don't approach the animal. Let it do what it wants to do, but try to make yourself bigger. Don't ever take your eyes off the animal. If it becomes more aggressive and keeps approaching you, that's when you start getting real defensive. And if worse comes to worse, you fight it out. Almost always, they know this isn't right. Something's not right.
This is not a deer. This is not a deer. Yeah.
Exactly. And yeah. Then they stop and tend to run away. And there's some conflicting information on this. We don't have all the facts yet, but they remained on the scene for a short time, and we don't know how long that is, just sort of gathering themselves, you know, asking if each other was okay, and did not leave immediately. And then out of nowhere, the cougar reappeared. But during that time, the second person turned and ran on foot. And that's what distracted the cougar, and part of the fighting probably did too, from letting go of the first victim and running after the second.
Look, mountain lions are throughout Washington State, estimated 2,000 cougars there.
Correct.
Until the 60s, the state paid hunters a bounty to kill them. Is there a current state management effort? Will there be rethinking about it? Or is this just, you know, part of being in nature? You might encounter a cougar.
It's tough to say what will happen here. We recognize the rarity of it, but the mountain lion is a protected species. It has been for almost 50 years, and we do have a hunting season on them, but it's a limited time frame, and we also limit the numbers to 250 statewide. You can still hunt them, but it has to be within the law. One of the things we're recommending, and we do on our website too, is that anyone that goes out into the woods to recreate, carry pepper spray. And because it works on all mammals, and we tend to associate pepper spray with bears, but it works on everything. And you can't have it in a backpack. You have to have it on your waist in a holster so you can grab it immediately and use it. Mm. And it's highly, highly effective, and it's something we recommend for everyone.
That's Richard Beaujolais, bear and cougar specialist with the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife. Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Boy, Peter, just terrible, yeah. You know, what happened. And that you're supposed to stand and fight, throw a rock, pick up a stick. I don't know.
Every fiber of your being is saying, get out of there and run.
Yeah. Terrible. But good information. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.